Members showed up to watch the giveaway. No law enforcement officers were in the area, but a helicopter did fly over City Hall. A Drug Enforcement Administration spokesman would not say whether or not it was a DEA helicopter. The giveaway was designed to focus attention on a raid September 5th at a pot farm in nearby Davenport. The raid ended with the seizure of 130 plants and the arrest of Valerie and Mike Corral. They were raising the plants for a medical marijuana cooperative. Last week, the city council passed a resolution calling on the DEA to stop pot raids that target medical marijuana operations. Oakland city workers rallied at City Hall today to express their frustration at the way the city council has handled their contract negotiations, which are at an impasse. Hundreds of Oakland city workers, represented by Professional and Technical Engineers Local 21 and the Service Employees International Union Local 790, gathered in front of the City Hall at noon for a boisterous rally to protest the impasse in their negotiations with the city for a new contract. The city workers have been without a contract since June. A state investigation has concluded Californians could have been spared blackouts at the height of the state's energy crisis if five big generating companies had kept their plants running at full capacity. The report is the latest salvo in state energy officials' ongoing fight with the merchant generators they accuse of taking advantage of the state's flawed bid to deregulate its power market, pocketing billions of dollars in the process. United Nations weapons inspectors and Iraqi officials have agreed to meet in Austria in 10 days to complete arrangements for the inspectors' return. The announcement came after a meeting at the United Nations where the U.S. and Russia are clashing over whether it's still necessary to confront Baghdad with new conditions or ultimatums. Iraq says the U.N. inspectors should be quick and honest in carrying out their task. The deputy prime minister also says Iraq is concerned that the United States might find a new reason to attack now that Iraq has agreed to let the UN team return unconditionally. America's Roman Catholic bishops have told President Bush they have grave reservations about a unilateral U.S. strike on Iraq. Bishop Wilton Gregory, who heads the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, says he delivered a letter to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice urging the president to use the United Nations to pressure Saddam Hussein for change. Gregory says the bishops find it difficult to justify extending the war on terrorism to Iraq unless there's strong evidence of Iraqi involvement in the September 11th attacks. Jewish groups are starting their first American television advertising campaign and will spend more than $1 million to promote Israel's side in its conflict with the Palestinians. The ads are to run on American cable news stations in 100 cities. Details on these and other stories coming up in the KPFA Evening News at 6. Stay tuned now for Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, Iraq agrees to allow UN weapons inspectors into the country. We'll speak to a former high-level official at the United Nations about the Iraqi decision. Also, part two of a documentary to commemorate the Israeli supervised slaughters at Sabra and Shatila 20 years ago. Reno, Rebel Without a Pause, and from New York City, The Night Report. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go to New York City for the Night Report with Robert Knight.
Weapons inspections at issue. I'm Robert Knight in New York. There's still no progress today for granting United Nations weapons inspectors full, unfettered, and unconditional access to production facilities for chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons of mass destruction at the Dugway Proving Grounds, Fort Detrick, or the Livermore Labs and Nevada Test Range in the United States. Nor is there any confirmation whatsoever that Iraqi jets have again bombed NSA radar installations in Vieques, Puerto Rico, and Fort Meade, Maryland, to enforce an East Coast no-fly zone to contain United States threats against Colombia, Cuba, and its Caribbean neighbors. There was, however, progress in Iraq. whose government agreed overnight to the unconditional return of U.N. weapons inspectors after an absence of 4 years. Following up on a hand-delivered letter from Saddam Hussein to U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz said today in Baghdad that, quote, if the inspectors come and act honestly, professionally, in order to check the truth, let them reach the truth within a reasonable period, end quote. President George W. Bush could not have been unhappier with the concession, issuing a statement that, quote, this is a tactical step by Iraq in hopes of avoiding strong U.N. Security Council action. As such, it is a tactic that will fail, end quote. Arms Inspector Hans Blix spent the day assembling a team he says could be ready in a week or two, while a tactical split emerged in the Security Council, with Russia saying the Iraqi offer makes further action by the Security Council unnecessary at this time, and that the inspectors do not need additional instructions. On the economic front, amid relief that an invasion has been forestalled for now, world oil prices plummeted today. And that is the root of the issue, according to Professor Michael Clare, professor of peace and world studies at Hampshire College in Amherst.
You see, Iraq has very large pool of untapped oil, tens, maybe hundreds of billions of barrels of oil. This may be the largest reservoir of untapped, unmapped oil in the world. And Saddam Hussein, over the past few years, has been awarding contracts to companies in friendly countries to explore and produce this oil when sanctions are lifted. And he's given preference to companies in Europe and China and Russia, I was going to say the former Soviet Union, Russia in particular, in a way, I think, to gain support for lifting of sanctions. So what is happening now is that the new government that the U.S. is getting ready to put in place to take over in Iraq has said that all of the contracts signed by Saddam Hussein will be voided by the new government and they'll be up for grabs. And what the United States is saying, in essence, to those countries, especially France, Russia, and China, is that if you support us at the UN Security Council, we will see to it that your contracts are protected. That is, contracts you've already signed will not be voided if you support us at the UN. So it's not like we're giving something away that we control. This is something these countries already have. We're saying we'll take it away from them if they don't support us at the UN.
Professor Michael Clare at Amherst. And in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go to Ireland, where we're joined by Dennis Halliday. Mr. Halliday was a former head of the UN Oil for Food Program and a former UN Assistant Secretary General, and he does join us from his home there. Mr. Halliday, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be with you again.
Well, the Iraqis have now said, yes, bring in the inspectors. The Bush administration is saying now that it's a ruse, a tactic. It will fail. It's not about inspections. It's about disarming. Could you respond first to the Iraqis' decision and then to the Bush administration's response?
I think the Iraqis have taken a very courageous move. And, of course, it's very good timing. It's strategic, obviously, by nature. But it does show some concern for the well-being of the people of Iraq. And I think this grows out of the fact that watching Al Jazeera last year, Iraq understands very well what would happen if there was to be an American attack on the country, if there were to be bombing attacks on cities and towns of Iraq. They saw what happened in Afghanistan, and they realized the consequences for the civilian population. So I think we've got to take it as a good faith, positive move. Although it's driven, of course, by fear of an American military attack if this were not to happen. Now, the fact is that we know from what Mr. Cheney has said and Mr. Rumsfeld that they don't really believe in military inspections anymore. They're not confident this will yield the results. But nevertheless, Mr. Bush has taken the issue back to the United Nations. And that means that the United States is bound by the discussions of the Security Council and the decisions of the Security Council. And the Council is, after all, wedded to sanctions, which are a legitimate part of the Charter and the provisions thereof. And I think they're going to have to give the Iraqis an opportunity now to be inspected properly by the United Nations and hopefully to get a bill of good health, clean health, so to speak, and hopefully satisfy the Security Council that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that some of the other conditions which Mr. Bush established, assuming they're legitimate within the international law and the charter, are satisfied. I can understand from the Bush point of view this must be somewhat frustrating because we know the feelings of possibly the president and certainly the vice president and the secretary of defense. But I think they're going to have to be patient and see how the UN moves now with this new breakthrough by Iraq and give inspections a genuine opportunity to work. I think that's where we stand today.
Well, I'm a little bit confused. Maybe you can help us understand this a little bit. They say it's not a matter of inspections. It's a matter of disarmament. But what I understand is that how do you know if a country is disarmed unless you have expert inspectors on the ground to investigate every aspect of that?
Well, you know, in the past, UNSCOM, which is the previous inspection agency, not only had expert teams drawn from various parts of the world on the ground for specific targets, whether it were nuclear, biological, or chemical. They also set up monitoring devices in any or some or all of the manufacturing capabilities within Iraq, largely destroyed by the UN, but nevertheless some of them were still standing, to make sure that manufacturing of any chemical or biological weaponry was simply not viable. So their presence was, in fact, quite impressive and I think provided the sort of information the Security Council required. So these inspections, which, if they are now reestablished, would require the same sort of capacity and the same capacity to destroy, because in the early 1990s, a massive capability was destroyed in Iraq by the United Nations. They destroyed over 900 long-range missiles. They destroyed any remnant of nuclear preparatory capability. They destroyed vast quantities of chemical and other weaponry. So they left behind, of course, defensive mechanisms. Iraq is allowed to have a defensive capability under the various resolutions governing the withdrawal from Kuwait. So that, of course, exists. But you're right to say this is a tricky issue. It's always going to be difficult to prove that you don't have something. There's not much goodwill on one side or even both sides. So that's what worries me, because that seems to indicate that if they wish, Washington will find a loophole which they may want to use to justify a military attack despite this change in policy.
Help us as best as you can. You're somebody who has a great deal of experience with the situation, the health situation, the impact of sanctions. You quit your job at the UN because of the impact of these ongoing sanctions. Give us your best understanding of what the situation is on the ground now and how hard these sanctions have impacted on the people of Iraq.
Well, first of all, the sanctions have had, I would say, just about no serious impact on the government itself. The impact has been felt by the people. And, of course, these are the very people who are innocent of any decision-making, say, vis-a-vis Kuwait. And, of course, most, well, I've forgotten exactly, 30-40% were not born when Kuwait was invaded. So we have, collectively, through the United Nations, been punishing the people of Iraq collectively for the crimes committed by their government. And, of course, that's in breach of law. The cost has been very high to families, to children in particular. The mortality rates for children have tripled in the last 10 years. We've seen figures from 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 deaths, unnecessary deaths of young children per month. And I think there's no doubt that the impact has been quite horrific. And this has come about partly through malnutrition of mothers and of children themselves, but also particularly through waterborne disease, which grew out of the deliberate decision by Washington to bomb electric power production and water processing and distribution systems in Iraq, which would provide or should have provided safe water. And for the last 12 years, in some areas, have not provided safe water with horrific health results. So we've seen heavy social economic impact and, of course, massive unemployment, loss of income, purchasing power, together with a crushed education system and a somewhat collapsed healthcare system. So there's no question about the impact. It's been quite horrific, and it needs to be terminated. It has not done anything to the regime. It simply endangered the well-being and lives of the innocent, the people of Iraq themselves.
When you say in breach of law, is this a bit of hyperbole, or is this really major violation of international law in terms of the sanctions that are really meant to impact on the people and not the government?
Yes, if you look at the Charter of the United Nations, it's very specific in establishing the rights of states and the rights of the civilians of those states to enjoy the basic human rights. And the basic human rights include such as education, health care, housing, employment, and the right to have family life and the right to life itself. In the case of Iraq, civil and political rights have been very much endangered or undermined by the government itself in Baghdad. But the basic human rights were largely satisfied by the government in Baghdad in the 70s and 80s, because that was the way that the Ba'ath Party, in a sense, stayed in power, by satisfying basic needs. For many Iraqis, that, in fact, was the first time they had opportunities for health care, education, employment, and so on. We in the United Nations, the United States, have allowed a regime of sanctions to be applied now for 12 years in the full knowledge that we have thereby undermined the same basic human rights I've just made reference to. And we've taken away the right to housing, education, employment, health care. We've very much crushed the well-being of the Iraqi people. This is in breach of law. We have undermined the Declaration of Human Rights, which was assembled, as you may recall, led by Eleanor Roosevelt, supported by the United States, and, of course, all the member states of the United Nations. Now, so we ourselves, tragically, the United Nations is in breach of international law. I mean, I could give you other examples, but that's one pretty simple one.
Now, if the U.S. were to go ahead with a coalition or without a coalition to declare war on Iraq, many are now saying, analysts believe, that the United States is interested in going in there. They're perhaps considering balkanization, splitting up Iraq, and if anybody else objects, splitting them up too. What would be the impact on the people of the region, the people of Iraq, if there was another full-scale war against Iraq?
Well, the first concern I have is the war itself. I think we in the United Nations, we cannot afford to have another Gulf War led by the United States under an umbrella of the United Nations, in which the various aspects of the Geneva Conventions are breached, such as the use of depleted uranium, such as the deliberate destruction of civilian infrastructure, such as the Basra Road massacres. I mean, these are crimes against humanity.
Remind people what that massacre was.
The Basra Road massacre?
Yes.
This was the opportunity seized by the Air Force flying off ships in the Gulf to attack retreating Iraqis and Palestinians out of Kuwait after the treaty had been signed, the agreement had been reached between Schwarzkopf and the Baghdad regime. And this was a broad daylight attack on people who were in full retreat as per the arrangement. So I think it's a horrific piece of modern history, which perhaps we try to forget, but it is a terrible reality. And many of us, I think, will remember being interviewed in the Gulf, these pilots, many of whom, I think, in later days were horrified by what they had been a party to.
And I think something like 80 or 100,000 people, it's hard to tell how many people were murdered in the process of retreating.
The figure I'm familiar with is 10 to 15,000 on the Basra Road. There were many other incidents which we have covered up and we've not explored, and it's something, anyway, we certainly don't want to see repeated.
I interrupted you. You were talking about the impact of the war. First, the actual attack.
I was going to get into then, you mentioned the word balkanization, and there is, I think, real concern in countries like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, possibly Jordan, that Iraq would, in fact, fall apart if it was destroyed, if the government was destroyed by an American attack. The Turks are very nervous that the Iraqi Kurds of the north, and we're talking 3.5, maybe 4 million people, would want to set in motion independence, some form of independence, which, of course, would attract the Kurds of Turkey, who may be as many as 12 or 15 million, to put together an independent Kurdish state, which, you know, was an option back in 1920. but thanks to Mr. Churchill, terminated. And the Kurds, quite rightly, have been frustrated ever since, and thus the risings against the Iranian governments, the Iraqi governments, and certainly the Turkish government. That would be one concern, certainly for the Turks and for the Iranians. In the south, you have a large Shia population. You know, 65% of the Iraqi people are Shia Muslims. And that's in contrast to Saudi Arabia, which has its own branch of the Sunni Muslim religion. And that there's nervousness there about a linkage between the Shia and the Iranians, who are also Shia. That scares the Gulf states and the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. So I think that the feeling is that we cannot afford to have Iraq disintegrate. And I think that's perhaps one of the motives back in 1991 that led to the termination of that first Gulf War. The need for the neighborhood and the need for American interests to keep Iraq intact. And that leads many of us, I think, to believe that the United States is not interested in democracy, per se, for Iraq. It's more interested in having some sort of friendly, hopefully benevolent dictatorship that would have a strong American bias and would protect American interests in the Middle East, particularly oil, of course, and particularly the well-being of Israel.
If some military visionaries like Rumsfeld has his way, and there is a real regime change, and if in fact there is a balkanization, would that benefit the United States?
As the United States can control those areas associated with oil production, I guess Washington would be reasonably happy. But I think they would run a severe risk of losing control, assuming that is the purpose, of oil supplies in Kirkuk, which the Turks have said they will occupy. But then, of course, Turkey is an ally, a friend of the United States, a member of NATO, so perhaps that oil supply would be addressed through Turkey. In the south, in the Gulf area, you'd have a different problem, perhaps. But again, you know, I guess that possibly could be resolved. But I don't believe this is acceptable to most of the Arab states, who are already, I think, very much concerned that an attack on Iraq is an attack on the Arab world, the Islamic world. And I think the governments in the Arab world who rely on American support are feeling nervous that their own people will not tolerate another war against Iraq, and that the governments might bear the consequences directly. So, you know, I don't see how Washington can be at ease with a war which may disrupt the stability of the Middle East and their own interests, vis-a-vis oil in particular.
And finally, back to the potential human rights problem in Iraq. If there were this bombing, we've already seen, as you've pointed out, tens of thousands of deaths based on water, on disease, on hunger. Where would this go next? What would happen? What would we expect to see?
Well, I think if we have an attack, and let's very much hope that does not happen, if we have another attack, and presumably it'll be a heavy bombing period of what, a couple of months, I dare say, to destroy the cities and towns and the military capacity that resides in and around those cities and towns, I think we'll see a complete breakdown of power, sanitation, and water, which in 91 led to cholera and outbreaks of disease and death in a matter of days. The next consequence would be a shortage of food supplies, because the shipping arrangements now operating under UN auspices by the government will also cease to exist, in that ships won't be allowed into the ports and so on. So we'd have starvation and famine conditions, I think, in a matter of weeks. So we would have a very dangerous situation in Iraq, and this is 22, 23 million people. So I think the possibilities of a significant catastrophe would be there were this the military attack to take place.
If you were immediately brought on as a special advisor to the President of the United States, what would be your advice?
My advice would be to pick up the Iraqi offer of military inspections and make sure it's done properly, without espionage, without intelligence endeavors. I would, as a gesture to the people of Iraq, I'd lift the economic embargo, and I would make very sure that those who sell arms to the world, the Middle East, and to Iraq, cease so doing. And then recognizing that 85% of military weapons today are manufactured and sold by the five permanent members of the Security Council. So I think Mr. Bush could do a lot of very good work, and he would be a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize. But more importantly, he would show the leadership, I think, and credibility of the United States, which would benefit not just the United States, but it would show that there's a new maturity in Washington, that peaceful solutions can be found, that we can work even with unattractive governments, because the right to change the system in Baghdad, of course, is the right of the Iraqi people. It's not the right of Mr. Bush nor anybody else. So only the Iraqis can do that. And I think if we give them the time and the opportunity, they will do that. And we've seen that happen in other countries. We've got to be patient. We've got to allow these things to change at a pace which suits the environment and the country in question. That's what I would suggest. And then lastly, I would suggest that Mr. Bush reopen the dialogue between Iraq and the United States, which after all was a very close relationship. Don Rumsfeld himself was there in 1983 and 1984. He met with Saddam Hussein. He actually took credit for bringing the relationship of the Iraq and the United States closer together. Let's reopen these relationships. We don't have to like the Baghdad government in order to work together in the interest of the Middle East, in the interest of peace, in the interest of Israel, and the interest of the Palestinians. I mean, I think that's the bigger issue, is peace, not whether we like somebody or whether we don't. We've got to, I think, grow up and be a little bit bigger and bring a civilized solution to the Middle East. And a dialogue is certainly a part of that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dennis Halliday, the former head of the UN Oil for Food Program in Iraq and a former UN Assistant Secretary General. I want to thank you very much for joining us from your home in Ireland.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Stronger than missiles and tanks. Oh, don't let life die in the ruins. No. More bombing, killing only escalates the hate.
It has been 20 years since the Lebanese militia and the Israeli military entered Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in southern Lebanon and slaughtered nearly 3,000 civilians. But the horror of the three-day massacre that began on September 16, 1982, continues for the Palestinians and for the Lebanese, who have yet to see those responsible for the genocide brought to justice. What follows is the second part of an audio documentary produced by Flashpoint special correspondent Nora Erekat, entitled Sabra and Shatila, We Refuse to Forget.
My name is Mohammed Abu Daina. I was, you can say, 6 years old during the massacre. I had a father and a mother and two sisters. I was born in the camp too. 1982, you know, the massacre and the Israeli invasion to Lebanon changed my whole life. After the massacre, I became alone. In September, the Israeli army or the Israeli troops, they surrounded our camps. We thought it's a normal procedure. They are intending to take the men and to investigate them, to question them about the massacre, about PLO, about the evacuation. This is what we thought about it. But we didn't imagine that these people would enter our houses to slaughter us inside our houses. So that's why my father said it's a normal procedure and don't worry about it. And even a woman, a Lebanese woman, she came, she barged to the house. She was bleeding. And she told them that they are slaughtering the people there and they are killing the children and the women and the pregnant women. My father did not believe her. He told her, stop these rumors and I'll take you to the hospital. He took her to the hospital, to Gaza hospital, and he came back. My mother, she started to scream, why did you come back? You shouldn't. She told her, you're a coward woman. I don't need the coward woman. Don't talk about it. That's enough. And the second day, they came to our neighborhood and to our alley, and they surrounded the house. My cousin, his name is Aida, she went out to the shop. She said that I bring some money and candles. And we heard her scream, and she didn't come back. Her father said,